ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Australian defence planners are currently very much preoccupied with concerns over Chinese ambitions in the Pacific region, in the South China Sea area particularly. It was true also more than seven decades ago now when Australia became involved in the Korean War. We sided with the US, Britain, Canada, New Zealand and other allies to push back a North Korean advance across the 38th parallel that divided communist North Korea from democratic South Korea. When the North Korean forces were eventually pushed back by the Allied efforts led by US General Douglas MacArthur, China entered the conflict, and Australia's Air Force and Navy were involved. But in the most intense period of the conflict, a lot of the hard fighting was done by the diggers of the 3rd Battalion of the Royal Australian Regiment. And the Battle of Kapyong in 1951 was perhaps the most crucial involvement of Australians during the Korean War, where the 3rd Battalion of the Royal Australian Regiment, alongside a battalion of Canadians, supported by the New Zealand artillery and US tanks, held back, an entire Chinese army division who were trying to overrun Seoul. Author and journalist Tom Gilling has written an account of the battle, and it's called The Diggers of Kapyong, the story of the Aussies who changed the course of the Korean War. He's here with us this evening. Tom, good evening. Welcome back to Nightlife.
Hello, Phil.
Let's set the background for this. I mean, the Korean War begins in 1950. We'll get to the battle, which is in April 1951. What's it all about? It's one of those wars that Australia was in, but we probably know the least about, don't we?
I think that's true, yes. Well, it started, as you say, with the North Koreans invading the South in June 1950. The Russians were boycotting their seat at the United Nations in those days because they thought that the Chinese seat ought to belong to the communists and not to the nationalists. Yeah. And so the UN, at American urging, was able to pass a resolution to throw the communists' army back out of South Korea. Now, if that hadn't happened, then it would have been a very different situation. But it meant that under American leadership, the UN could form an army to push the communists back, and Australia was one of the first countries to join up.
So it was in that kind of frenzied 1950s anti-communist mood that all this was taking place.
And it was.
That's why Australia joined.
That's right. And I think a lot of the soldiers felt that this was actually going to be a prelude to a much bigger war. They thought that it would be a war against Stalin's Russia. But as it turned out, it was a war against Mao's China. But yes, it was widely thought, I think, that the next big war would be a war against communism.
So who were Australian troops under the control of?
They were under MacArthur's control.
Okay, so MacArthur was the overall commander.
From Japan. He would occasionally fly in from Japan to to Korea if there was some big announcement to be made, but he largely ran it from Tokyo.
It was... I think one of the reasons that we don't know so much about it is that it wasn't a conscript war, wasn't it? It was, from Australia's point of view, they were all professional soldiers.
Correct. A lot of them had served in the occupying army in Japan. So Australia contributed to an army occupying Japan from the end of the war until 1949. And that army had been gradually whittled down. And the last Australians were about to go home when North Koreans invaded the South. And so the few who were left in Japan were quickly assembled as part of a force to go to Korea, and it wasn't big enough, and so they had to call for volunteers in Australia. And a lot of old diggers who'd fought in the Pacific, who'd fought at Kokoda, they were the ones to volunteer for Korea.
How many went? I mean, in total of Australians?
Look, all three battalions of the Royal Australian Regiment went, plus the Navy and the Air Force, many thousands. So obviously there were rotations, but at any one time, much fewer than that. But in the first year of the year or so, just the 3rd Battalion, which was about 1,000 men.
It was pretty fierce fighting, actually, too, wasn't it? In terrible conditions, because the geography of Korea is not conducive.
No.
Well, I think orderly battle, is it?
Correct. They remember it largely as a country of hills. And dreadful winters, yeah. Biting winters that they were in no way prepared or equipped to deal with. And the big advantage that they would have had with tanks was only sometimes able to be exploited
because of the geography. The tanks weren't that useful, were they?
Correct.
Whereas yes. artillery was.
Yes.
Where is Cabillon anyway? What's the
Cabillon is about 10-15 kilometers north of Seoul. Mm-hmm. I think that's right. Maybe a little bit further, but it was on the traditional invasion route where armies coming down from the north throughout history had invaded through the Cabillon Valley before taking Seoul. So strategically, it was.
So they got that far. They got that far down. They were quite close.
Well, they'd got a lot further earlier. Yeah. They'd pushed the United Nations forces down into the very bottom southeast corner, and the war was very nearly lost within that first year. Mm. This was after the United Nations had pushed the war all the way up to the Chinese border, and then it had been pushed back down again.
Yes, it came and went. That's right. There was fierce fighting too. So this particular battle, the fate of Seoul was up for grabs. So you've got three RAR there alongside us, AHU. We've got the US.
There's a Canadian battalion of infantry, yeah. And there's a battalion of New Zealand artillery, right. Which was crucial, very skillful, the Kiwi gunners. And then there were some American tanks. So all up, probably no more than 3,000 men altogether.
I mean, what were they up against?
They're up against a Chinese division of probably 10,000, maybe a bit more.
Wow. Heavily outnumbered. Mm. They were dug in, were they, or not?
Well, it was very tough country to dig into. Some parts of it they could dig a foxhole for themselves. Other times they just had to pile stones around them.
So what happened? Take us through the battle. How did it start?
It started with the Chinese had just begun their spring offensive, and that was just on the 22nd of April. Immediately, the South Korean 6th Division did what it had often done during the war, which was disintegrate. So the South Koreans were streaming back away from the Chinese. They were streaming back through the Cabillon Valley. And the 27th Commonwealth Brigade, which was of which the Australians were part, was the only fighting force there to try and hold the Chinese up at Cabillon. So it wasn't big enough to hold them. It really was an area that needed at least two brigades to defend it, and so the commander had to spread his troops very thinly, and it ended up with three RAR on two hills side by side overlooking a road where the Chinese would march down.
Tell us about Hill 504. Why was that a key location?
It was the larger of the hills. It was on the eastern side of the road. Three of the four companies in the battalion were on that hill, and one company was just across the road on a ridge. And so they commanded.
So they had a commanding spot in that sense, a strategically commanding spot.
They were well located, yeah, but they were facing a much bigger force.
Were the Chinese well equipped, or were they just infantry?
They were infantry. They were equipped with grenades and burp guns. The Allies called them burp guns. That was the sound they made. They were those Chinese with a drum barrel ammunition underneath it.
Uh-huh. Okay. So they were seasoned fighters though, because they'd been in Korea for a while.
The Australians or the
Chinese?
The Chinese. They were, and a lot of the Koreans had fought in the Chinese Revolutionary War before. So they were certainly seasoned, and they were indoctrinated. So they were a very powerful group.
Mm. Where was the Korean army?
The Korean army.
Did the Korean army exist?
It did exist, and it was big, but it was a bit flaky. No one wanted to be positioned with a Korean division on their wing because they tended to disintegrate at the first sign of the Chinese, and it happened several times that the Australians had witnessed that on New Year's Eve. The South Korean division beside them had crumbled, and So again, they poured back, throwing brand new American weapons and equipment on the road as they left. So the Australians weren't that surprised to see it happen again at Kapiong, but it was always a challenge because it left flanks exposed.
Tom Gillings with us, author and journalist, author of a number of books. His latest, The Diggers of Kapiong, telling the story of the pivotal battle in the Korean War, which Australians were very much involved with. The Australians eventually had to withdraw, didn't they?
They did. So
how was that achieved?
They'd stopped the Chinese from breaking through, but it was clear that they wouldn't be able to hold another night because the Americans were supposed to be galloping to their rescue and then decided not to. So the Australians had to pull out. They were pretty certain that the Chinese would be commanding the ridge that they would have to withdraw along. So they withdrew in a sort of leapfrogging style where one battalion would stand, one would prepare to move. Sorry, not one battalion, one company would stand, one would prepare to move and the other would move. And so they leapfrogged each other back down that ridge, which they had assumed would be covered by the Chinese, would be because the Chinese had been watching them all day. They were very fortunate in having very accurate and committed New Zealand artillery supporting them. So sometimes they were firing within 150 metres of the Australians themselves, but they managed to get back with only, their only casualty was one man captured.
Is that right?
Mm.
Out of the whole, one man captured, that's it?
Yeah, it was an extraordinary achievement.
Yes, the were they recognised by the Americans for what they'd achieved?
Well, when I started my research on this book, I read David Halberstam's book on the Korean War, which is about 750 pages long, and I couldn't find the word Kapiong anywhere in the
index.
Is that
right? Yes. Really?
So they if you read about it at all from an American point of view, it tends to be described as a small holding action, something not very significant. But strategically, it was extremely significant.
The veterans, well, there would be veterans still alive, wouldn't there?
Very few.
There would not many, I agree.
But yeah.
They'd be in their 90s anyway.
I think they'd be pretty even close older. To 100, actually, yeah, because most of them were Second World War vets.
That's true.
And they were quite, you know, but a lot of them were experienced soldiers in the Second World War.
Did you actually manage to speak to any?
I wasn't able to speak to any. I spoke to some for a book I wrote about a Second World War battalion. And they, both of those old diggers were, they both died since, but they were both nearly 100 when I spoke to them.
Yeah.
And I thought it would be very difficult to track anyone down.
Yeah, no, so I think so. When I'm reflecting on my question now, I think actually they would all be either dead or too old, I would think, to speak. Author and journalist Tom Gillings with us. We're talking about the story of the Aussies who had a pivotal role in one of the key battles of the Korean War. It was a bit like the Vietnam experience when they came back too, wasn't it? Distant Asian War. People weren't that interested. They were interested in rebuilding lives after the Second World War.
That's right.
And it was a war that just never really got talked about, did it?
I think that's right. And of course it was before the television age. So
yeah, that's right.
Whereas Vietnam caused huge controversy and angry debate, the Korean War much less so. And so on top of the fact that I think probably many Australians felt like a lot of the diggers, that this was a war that in the end was going to have to be fought to keep communism at bay.
And, well, at bay is the word here, because the war never ended.
As we know,
famously, the war has not ended.
That's right. Yeah.
It's never been a declaration of the cessation of hostilities. There's just a zone, the 38th parallel, where, you know,
that's right. It was an armistice.
The DMZ, as they call it, the demilitarized zone, which is still an active war zone, actually.
Yes. And is looking a precarious place, even more precarious than usual now, because Kim Jong Un, who's the grandson of Kim Il Sung, who started the Korean War, has recently announced that South Korea is their permanent and perpetual enemy. He could be winding up for something, sort of provocation that has happened over the years, or something more serious.
Indeed. We'd like to rate the South Korean army as a bit more competent than they were back in those days.
That would be helpful.
Tom Gilling, it's a great chapter that you've written of Australian military involvement in this as I say, somewhat forgotten war, the Korean War. The book is called The Diggers of Kapyong, and it's out in the shops right now. Good on you, Tom. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Phil.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.